First of all, I'll say good morning and happy Halloween to all of you. We could say go Giants. My husband is a big Giants fan, so he's wondering why I'm here and not on the street in black and orange, but I do have those other responsibilities. I will say that this work is in collaboration with Margarita Lightfoot, who is not here today, and Margarita and I have collaborated a lot over the years on work related to mostly adolescent populations. I will say we're going to shift things a little bit for this presentation because what I'm not going to be talking about outcomes from an intervention study or presenting epidemiologic data. What I'm really going to be talking about are the challenges of engaging families in research. And just to provide you with a little frame for this, my background and most of my work is on homeless populations, primarily homeless adolescents. Done a lot of work, and both epidemiologic and intervention work. And the thing that I focus on the most is having us begin to understand at-risk adolescents within the context of what we call normative adolescent development. And what is very important for adolescents to have healthy outcomes are families and family relationships. So my work really is targeted at figuring out how to work with vulnerable adolescent populations within the broader context of their family systems. So that's really, I want to share that with you, which led to this work that I'm going to talk about today. So I, of course, have no relationships to disclose. I will say that my affiliations have changed a bit. I am not at the Center for Community Health. I'm actually at the Nathanson Family Resilience Center at UCLA. And my work has been funded by both NIMH and NIDA. And also, I think I didn't put NIDA on the slide, so I'm glad Dion is not here because I would be greatly remiss. And also, we have new work that's funded by the National Institute on Mental Health and Health Disparities. So what I want to talk to you a little bit this morning is I'm going to really talk about the challenges of having families of what we call delinquent youth participate in evidence-based family interventions. I'm going to talk a little bit about strategies that have been suggested in the literature for engaging families. I'm going to also talk about a strategy that we developed, the lessons we learned, and the implications. And, of course, I'm a researcher, so we always have to talk about the implications for future research in this area. So, delinquent adolescents. These are young people who are under 18 years old. They are often from ethnic and racial minority groups in the U.S., and I'm talking about adolescents in the U.S. Many are African American and Latino or Latina. When we think of delinquent adolescents, typically the way we define it, it's children or young people under the age of 18 who've committed a crime, or they've been apprehended, or they have been adjudicated through the juvenile justice system. This population of adolescents are at risk for HIV. They often have unprotected sex. Their sexual activity is associated with drug use. And those who are probably most at risk they're obviously sexually active. They tend to initiate sexual activity at younger ages. They have multiple sex partners. So clearly this is a population that is prime for HIV interventions. And I should also say, within this group, probably those who are the most at risk have higher levels of we see comorbidity. So there are higher levels of both substance use and mental health problems, primarily internalizing behaviors and depression. So when we think about family-based interventions, and why do we want to use them? First of all, it's delinquent adolescents are a difficult population to intervene with, so why do I then want to add the additional burden of trying to do family interventions? And it's really because new work, some of the work of Mary Jane Rothenboris and her colleagues, some of the work that I've done on homeless adolescents really suggests that a way to achieve success in reducing HIV risk behaviors is to really think about not just these individualized interventions, but to think about the broader social context and family systems. Our work, primarily with homeless adolescents and other people's work as well, has showed that positive family relationships and positive social interactions to family have been linked to reducing HIV risk behaviors. But the challenge, though, is that participation in family interventions is low. Even when you're working with families in transition, if they have a new baby, kids transitioning from middle school to high school, there's a lot of work in that area, and participation tends to be low. But it's Tolu Shams says, and I quote her, she really feels that for delinquent adolescents, family-based interventions are really an unexplored area, an important area to think about. So when I talked about low participation, many studies have intervention completion rates when you do family interventions of like 25%, less than 50%. So we decided to think about how we could really address participation. And when we think about participation, we're really talking about recruitment, engagement, and retention. And prevention science tends to look at these three aspects of participation. Even though most studies that have been done that have looked at participation have really focused on either one or two of these dimensions. So we, because we're always up for a challenge, decided to look at all three dimensions. And when we looked at the literature, what previous research has shown is that these broad categories of characteristics are related to either recruitment, engagement, or retention. So, for example, when you look at things that predict or are related to high retention, demographics such as higher income and higher educational attainment, if you look at characteristics of a child, things like higher GPA, more severe problem behaviors. When you look at family characteristics, you find things like if the family's able to be organized, if they're able to juggle kind of the demands of the research project or the intervention with their own home and work schedule. So if they tend to report also fewer barriers, if you can address transportation issues, childcare issues. There are also intervention characteristics that are related to participation, things like matching the race ethnicity of the project staff and the participants, using incentives, the issue of trust, if you're able to build trust, and we've seen when you're able to build trust, you are able to retain participants. You're also able to recruit. And the other is really, another aspect of the intervention that's important for family interventions is when the goals of the intervention really match the goals of the family. And I'll talk more about that in a minute. So what we did was we took all of these, we took what previous research had suggested, and it helped us think about a strategy that we could use for improving participation. One of the things that, so even though previous research was suggested some promising areas to think about, many of the characteristics that I listed on the board, those aren't malleable. You really can't do much with them. And the other thing is that rarely do we actually study strategies for improving participation. We tend to look at it retrospectively. We go back and run our analyses and see what worked and what didn't work. We don't take a prospective approach One thing that has been looked at prospectively, really for getting people into treatment, has been motivational interviewing. And there's many studies, a large literature documenting that motivational interviewing is efficacious in getting people into treatment. But when you think about strategies for participation, something else that's talked about are cultural, what we think of as cultural factors. I mentioned some of them kind of, and they're really around race, ethnicity, or social class. So one is this notion of matching the participants and the people who are doing the intervention. But I want to step back a little bit and talk about some cultural issues that I'm going to focus primarily on African-American families as an example. So when you look at African-American families and you look at participation retrospectively, they report that if they have fewer barriers, that if they're organized, and if you can get them, if you can develop motivation, that that's going to be linked to higher retention. A lot of studies tend to address the kind of logistical barriers around class, so we provide transportation and child care. Trust and is often both built into interventions but also discussed as a barrier, especially for African Americans. We often go back to the Tuskegee study and talk about the unethical practices. But interestingly, when people have done some empirical work, that has had less of an impact on recruitment and retention than we think. We kind of talk about it conceptually. There is some work that's actually looked at it empirically. And what that work has shown is that even with the Tuskegee study, you can build trust if you've got good communication. And I think that's in part what Hillary was talking about a little bit. Clearly, Wendy's talked about too, and that's, so if you have good communication between the research team and the participants, and you have, I'd say, communication that's clear and compelling and sensitive. And so those issues haven't been talked about, so that can improve recruitment. So we took, and then this notion of incentives. If we provide incentives, we will get people in. Wendy talked a lot about the food insecurity in South Africa, so providing food is a big incentive. All of us know getting, when we've got these nice NIH study funded projects, can't pay for food, so we have to figure out other strategies, other ways to do that. I think it's really interesting to have kind of the work that's done in South Africa and having the work that's done in the U.S., because I think there's so much parallel between South Africa and the U.S. in terms of marginalized populations. So we don't often think about food insecurity here with some of the populations that we work with, but that's an issue around the incentives. So we know that incentives work. So just let me talk a little bit about the work that I'm going to finally get to and talk about. So with all of those things in mind, we developed a study to really test a strategy for increasing participation of families of delinquent youth in family-based intervention. You can ignore the whole theoretical model at the top and just focus on the enhanced strategy at the bottom. So what we did was, based on previous research, what we knew from our work, we developed an initial enhanced strategy for getting people, for bringing families into intervention. So we developed a motivational DVD, we had a motivational recruitment session, we had the initial idea of doing a pre-session where families could tell their story and really begin to think about how their goals might match the intervention goals. We end each session, plan to end each session with a positive, so when people leave, they're leaving on a high note. We're trying to do sessions in home and, of course, have a racial ethnic match of the staff. So this is just an overview of the research that we did. It's a two-phase study. So what we did was we proposed and carried out a study to develop an enhanced strategy for participation. We tested this strategy with using randomized design with African-American adolescents and their parents in Los Angeles County. We recruited adolescents from what's called, it's the Los Angeles County Office of Education. It's essentially the alternative school system for Los Angeles County. So these are probation schools, alternative schools. I will say in LA County, alternative education can range from gifted and talented to what we typically think of as delinquent youth, so very wide range. But we went into the community day schools or the probation schools. Just as a little point of interest, very interesting working in these schools. And I'm going to come back to the point about delinquent youth. And if you noticed, I had it in quotes, and I'll say a little more about that at the end. So one of the things we discovered being in these schools is that these alternative schools for kids who have even been involved in the juvenile justice system, they provide a safe environment for them. Because these are schools in LA County that have zero tolerance for gang behavior. And there are a lot of kids who kind of get caught up in gangs, but you have an equal number of kids who are trying to get away from that. And these schools provide an environment for them. So it's kind of, and it's why I want to get back to the delinquent youth issue at the end. So we carried out this study, and the first thing that we did was kind of our phase one work to develop this inspirational, motivational DVD. We did key informant interviews with parents, school people, people from the juvenile justice system. And we also did focus groups with parents and adolescents and key informants. We worked with a media developer to help us prepare the work. So we developed this motivational DVD with what I call an artist, with really a filmmaker at the UCLA Chicano Studies department. That was both fun and challenging because I'm kind of OCD and very like, it's like we've got to stay on track, we only have this much money. And the artist I worked with was, well, what type of music do we want? And I'm commissioning a piece. And so we were kind of sometimes on different tracks, but it was interesting. So we developed this DVD, and this is where I experienced some technical difficulties this morning because we thought it was embedded. It's not. I wanted to share it with you. If you are interested in seeing the DVD, I'd love for you to see it. You can contact me and I'll give you a link so that you can see it. I'll tell you a little bit about it. It's very nice, quick, 2 minutes. It talks about family-child dynamics, talks about goals, presents it in a way that we move from really kind of a negative focus to a positive focus. I think it's a nice piece of work. Things that we learned, so I talked about this kind of enhanced strategy. So I just want to tell you a little bit about our findings. We found that the strategy really did improve recruitment, improved retention, and this is comparing our enhanced strategy to a standard strategy. We were really interested in testing the strategy, so both groups got the intervention. The intervention that we used is Guiding Good Choices, which is an evidence-based, family-based, NIDA-sanctioned intervention. It's a brief 5-session intervention. Lessons learned. One of the things that we learned is that we really could go with fewer sessions, so we didn't do that pre-session that I talked about. We really built that into our first session. We really had time for people to share their goals, share their stories. We also, being in the alternative schools, we were focused on African-American adolescents and their parents and guardians. We really needed to also think about including Latino adolescents, their parents and guardians. We have done that in our work going forward. One of the things that we plan to do is to deliver the intervention in home sites, and usually when I do family interventions, that's what I do, even with homeless young people and their parents or guardians. But we found that school sites were a better place to deliver the intervention because we were able to have the parents work with one another and build some support for some of the skill building that they needed to do. We also learned that we had to be flexible. I tend to think of us as being very flexible researchers, but we had to really kind of meet people where they were in terms of scheduling sessions and things like that. What I will say about this work is that when we think about strategies for enhancing participation, we really need to think much more about those contextual barriers. You know, we're always thinking about the incentives, we're thinking about building trust, but what our work shows is that if you work with families to really help them understand how the intervention can work for them and how it can match their goals, their priorities, that you can increase participation. I will say we were less effective with engagement, and I think more work needs to be done in that area. I've gone through this very quickly, but engagement's really, it's not, kind of goes beyond retention and, recruitment, but kind of their perceptions of the intervention there, the way that we defined engagement was coming to all the intervention sessions versus, you know, one or two or three out of the five sessions. So this last part I've gone through pretty quickly. I will stop and take questions. Minimal. I did this work on an R21.
Okay, got it.
Okay, I did this on an R21. Staff was minimal, but I will say this because we had this kind of pre-conversation about delegating, so I'll share this with the group. I'm not a delegator, but I kind of delegated the media part of my slides, and it was not successful, but that's okay. But with this, because I didn't have a huge staff, I ended up doing a lot of the field work myself, which actually was excellent, and I'm glad that I did it, because for those of you who are emerging investigators, it's like, a lot of grunt work. I'll just use that term. And for those of you who are seniors, sometimes we're not in the field as much as we used to. But being in the field, delivering the intervention myself at times, just made a big difference for me in terms of understanding it, seeing how things work, and then also just some of the logistics, too. LA County is a huge county. So I would have, when I've done other project staff, Narita, it's going to take me 2 hours to get there. Well, just to give you context, I live in Pasadena, which is kind of southeast of where UCLA is. And then doing this work, I was a lot of times in more eastern and southern parts of LA County. But I could manage it and get there in time. So one of the things I could tell my staff, if I can get from Pasadena to there in an hour, so can you. So it's things like that. But more importantly, I think working with the families, I really got a real sense of how much families want these types of interventions. And I don't think we fully appreciate in the U.S. for marginalized populations how much of a struggle it is. So for example, I had a mom to get to the session. She lost the use of her car. She would take three buses to come to the sessions. But there'd be times when families would not show, but I would be wherever I needed to be every week, knowing that sometimes they would make it, sometimes they wouldn't make it. And those are things, if you've not been in the field for a while, you don't have a good sense of. So it's kind of a long-winded way of answering your question.
No, I think that's one of the biggest issues. I mean, doing intakes on a bus, it's just so long you get to come back and all, so on. Okay, we got permission from IRB, go out and do all that, including biologicals, but, you know, you just put up a little camp, hide in place, screen, the whole thing.
Yep.
For transportation is an issue?
Transportation, I think, but also I feel that it's also being in the communities where people are. And when you go and you're there, it does build trust. It does show commitment. The other thing I would say for some of the reluctance for families of, and I didn't get into a lot of detail, is that they are not often in interventions where they can be empowered and feel that they can take charge. And our interventions, and even Guiding Good Choices, these are so psychoeducational. So it's really building skills for them and helping them take charge. And that's important too. So.
No, that's
Any other questions?
Or for any of the other speakers as well?